First time.
Everett, and you're listening to The First Time here on Six Music and BBC Sounds. This is the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and take a look at the pivotal first musical moments that made them who they are today. And my guests this week are from a four-piece band who formed in Versailles, France, in 1995, one of an astonishing generation of French artists who emerged at that time. This band built on early collaborations with Daft Punk and DJ producer and composer Philippe Zadar, and their career has gone from cult indie success to film soundtracks, massive albums and Madison Square Gardens and Coachella Festival headlining sets. I'm very pleased to say my guests on The First Time this week are Thomas and Christian from Phoenix. You just heard Listomania from the band's huge Wolfgang Amadeus Phoenix album, a record which led to huge global success in 2009. But it wasn't always so. And over the course of the next hour, we'll hear how a seminal My Bloody Valentine gig brought the band together, how a terrible show at a street festival alongside Daft Punk drove them forward, and how they feel about US jocks singing along to their hits. We'll also hear about their experience recording their latest album, Alpha Zulu, in the Louvre in Paris, and how their memories of their dear friend and collaborator, the late great Philippe Zadar, permeated that album. But I started off by asking Thomas and Christian, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time they were aware of music?
Personally, with my brother, the other guitar player, I remember dinner in Italy. Half of our family is Italian. And I remember my father had a cousin. He would bring his guitar at the end of dinners, and I remember. I have a vague memory, but suddenly the dinner came into a chaos, a fantastic, like a voyage, you know.
And you were like that.
Yeah, that was the first. Yeah, the first moment for us.
What would he have been playing?
I think he was playing Beatles and like classic Italians, like Lucio Battisti, you know.
And me was.
I think it was a 7-inch vinyl that was from Alain Souchon, like a very poppy, handsome kind of singer-songwriter. And he made... my parents had the vinyl. My parents didn't listen to music a lot, but that song, when it was on, it sounded like candy. It was not music. It was like a toy. The sound was... So, to me, it was as appealing as... It was like sugar and candy. It was that was. I guess I must have been five or something. But that's. There were two songs on it. They were both great. Jamais content and Bidon. And I would switch back and forth forever. That's why. To me, it's very important whenever we do a vinyl or when we put out a 7-inch. Yeah, the back and forth. Both have to be good so you can play them forever.
Yes.
Que je pleure tout le temps, que je suis comme un tout petit enfant qui aime plus ses jeux, sa vie, sa maman. Elle dit que je pleure tout le temps, que je suis carrément méchant, jamais content. Carrément méchant, jamais content. Déjà mes parents dans le temps voulaient que j'aille faire le charmant chez les amis de mon grand-père, des pharmaciens, des notaires, qui me trouvaient carrément vulgaire, très ordinaire.
What about the first single that you owned, the first single that you bought? Because that's, when you own something as a kid, that's different. It becomes precious.
Again, a toy for me, because it was Zig Zig Sputnik, Love Missile, F-111.
That's a great song.
Yeah. And that was, I mean, it looked like Transformers on the cover of Flaunted, of the album, is Transformer. It's a toy. So I love the artwork of that album. And then the single looked like a strange dystopian punk, over-the-top punk. Yeah.
The hair and the fishnets on the face.
Yeah, almost like a Hollywood Adam and the Ant. You know, like a strange... Yeah, I love that one.
Also, like guitars, technology, pop music. I mean, this is basically where you ended up, isn't it?
Yeah, actually, on the last album, there's one song, very after midnight.
Yeah, that's after, very.
We are thinking about this band.
Yeah.
Your first single?
My first single, I think it was Billie Jean by Michael Jackson. Yeah. Yeah, big, very important for my brother and I. Yeah.
Okay, what about first gig you went to that really, first concert that you saw and moved you then? What kind of age would that be?
Me, I can answer easily. It was when we were 15. Olympia, actually, we're going to play this venue in 1 week. Olympia in the heart of Paris. It was My Bloody Valentine.
Right.
Many French musicians, the guys from Daft Punk were there, I remember. When we were all teenagers, and it was a big shock, because to see a band with no compromises, you know, sound wise, it was unbelievable. It was,
yeah, because you've talked about No More Sorry being like and My Bloody Valentine being the sort of thing that brought you together when you first started playing. Is that right?
Yeah, because it's the one band that you couldn't play. If you had a trip with your parents in the car, that you were not allowed to play My Bloody Valentine. It's insulting to their ears, you know. Well, other things, everything that happened before, my parents were really nice. They would tolerate it. But My Bloody Valentine, that was the tipping point. And that's the kind of band that you need when you start a band to define what you know, who you are and how you... So they were essential to... I think we discovered they came at the right time, too. Because before that, my first show was... I went to a few really bad punk shows because I had a sort of a sister that would take me to these shows when I was really young. And I was scared because I was around these... I was like 10. And it felt like it wasn't safe, but I enjoyed amplified sounds.
Yeah.
You know, I enjoyed the loud. And then I went to see Supertramp in 85.
Ooh.
And like a big, which I loved, but it sounded like very serious music. Mm. You know, the crowd going there was, it was a little serious compared to. And then I feel like My Bloody Valentine is really when we found something where like, okay, this is... It validates every point, you know, it checks all the boxes and yeah.
Interesting, the punk show, because I think some Phoenix shows can be pretty punk.
Coming from Versailles, everything we do is punk,
yeah, you know,
but nothing really. So it depends of, it's where you're looking from, uh-huh. You know, it's the cursor moves a lot. But yeah, to us, anything we did, playing music, any kind of music in Versailles, it was already a... was already punk because music was not really welcome anymore. You know, it was not, there were no place to play a show or there was no, so we stayed in our basement and we were producing records, we were making albums.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause you talked about with the Beatles, the only Beatles song you were allowed to hear at school.
Yeah.
Tell me that story. Cause I just find it's lovely.
Well, Obladi Oblada was the only Beatles song, which is, of course, it's the one they picked that's the least threatening, the least... And on the surface, it sounds like they had to pick a Paul song for sure, but they picked one that sounds like a children's... just a children's song. And when they explained... The way they explained this song to us was almost as if they wanted us not to be attracted to any form of music, you know. It was something that was so unappealing. It took us years to undo what the education system did in Versailles, how their approach to, and they go straight to you know, things that are very technical and boring, but not even the good technical side. They don't show you how, I think because they didn't know, they were just, this is what's popular, this is and they thought it was so edgy for them to reach out in that territory, you know, to play you something like this.
So what was the school? Tell me about music lessons in the school then.
The year when we were there was the first year that punishment was not allowed anymore. So the teachers were about to hit you, but they were like, at the last second, they were not going to hit you. Which, in a way, was worse because they kept their anger for the entire school year. You know, they couldn't release it. I just remember going to school under this, with like people hating the anger and the lack of respect for the kids and for the, it was brutal. And the music lessons were as threatening as other, you know, it should be like PE or music should be, they were even worse. You know, PE was full on military and music school was, you either learn how to play the triangle or the flute, which I refused to. Flute was mandatory until a certain point, and then they had to ask because you had to pay for your flute. And I said, no, I'm not buying the flute. And I was the only kid in the class not playing the flute while everybody else was playing the flute. That's all I remember from that time.
But then you hear obla-di obla-da, and they think it's safe, but there's a part of your little teenage brain, or part of your child brain, yeah, that's going...
Yeah, I think you still hear it through those lessons, those school... But it was surreal. It was I wish we'd tape it. Or I have, you know, some because it's the best YouTube. It'd be the most, the silliest way to explain a Beatles song. It's after this, you either go into music, you have to rediscover music. You have to start from scratch.
Okay, so when you started playing together, like, were you like, lots of really new bands when you're young, you're like really ambitious and you draw your logo and you work out what the stage is going to look like and yeah, you really have a vision. I would think you were that kind of band.
Yes.
Yes. No, logos, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, we are.
Yeah.
We had t-shirts very, very early.
Exactly, that's
like
what I
few, mean. I still have one to sleep in.
What was on the t-shirt?
It was the first name of the first band, even before I joined the band, when they were 13, Boxon.
Which means mess.
Mess.
It's a French slang for mess.
And the t-shirt is very...
We were 10.
Very good quality t-shirt. I mean, the logo was super cool.
The t-shirt was better than the music. The t-shirt is still good. Still good. A good...
So yeah, we had plans, yeah, because we wanted to escape reality, you know. Mm. And so we were making plans as teenagers. We're going to be like this, we're going to travel the world. Yeah. And yeah, we were really into it. Yeah, super. We are only talking about the first moment I entered the school, when I was 15, I saw one guy dressed in black. He was the black sheep. That was Thomas, for real. He was... And after 10 seconds, we were friends, you know, it was... And we were only talking about music, and no one knew we had a band, almost no one, yeah. It was our secret, you know. We didn't want to share it, you know. It was not a hobby, it was very important. So, yeah, we had big plans.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the first gig, we've got to do these first, the first live in front of an audience. Can you remember what
I think
was?
My father taped it, and it was for... Fête de la Musique, Music Fest, you know, on the first day of summer in 91, I think. And it was in the street, you know, on the street, where cool, with people who were walking in front, you know. I've seen the footage again.
Really?
No one cared, you know.
And nobody cared.
Nobody. And we are doing super loud music, and no one cared. And before us, there was my brother with the two other Daft Punk guys. Mm-hmm. With a band called Darling. No one cared too. But, yeah, so that was my first gig, yeah.
Do you think that was maybe you and the Daft Punk guys? Being ignored is the like, well, that, I'll show you.
Yeah.
If you don't care, we will show you that we're good.
I don't think it was about revenge or anything, but it was. It showed that we had confidence, that we were like... And also, we cared about the music they were doing. They cared about the music. Well, you know, there was like, the backstage was more thrilling than the, you know. But like, oh yeah, you're playing with this. Okay, you're. They opened with, they covered Kiss, the love theme from Kiss. And as soon as I saw them, I saw like Guy Manuel's silhouette because he had really long hair. He looked really cool. And the beginning, I was like, wow, this is like okay, this is somehow a scene that's building. You know, this is somehow like, because I'm going to copy, I'm gonna buy the pants he's wearing. I'm gonna, so you feel like the beginning of something.
Yeah.
And then it sort of exploded because everybody went in different directions because, you know, everybody started making music in their studio and not really playing live for a while. So yeah. Then it was like sampler. It was, we were all stuck in our bedroom for 3 years after this until we played shows again.
What was the first time you went into a studio to record something that would come out? First single, I guess.
That was 99, right?
First album, yeah. And it was, when we recorded for United, our first album.
Right. Were you as focused on the studio as well? Did you know? Because that first time, like, because it's money. It costs money.
Yeah,
to
we, yeah. We were scared.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a kind of a trauma, you know. We, because we were waiting all our life for this moment, and we were so scared to, because we didn't know. We were just, we learned everything watching videos, you know, how the guys play chords. We didn't know anything,
really?
No names of the chords, nothing. So to be in a real, and the studio was one of the, maybe the best studios still from the 70s. It's called Gong. Actually, Daft Punk, they still own this studio. They don't own, but they have it all year long now. It's a fantastic studio. So the pressure was, we were. So then after, we kind of avoided big studios.
First meeting Philippe Zadar.
He met him before. You met him before I did. You went to the exhibit, to the, there was an art opening maybe, or?
Yeah. With fashion people, you know, like a bit snob people from Paris. And we look at each other and I was like, how snob this guy is. And he looked at me and he thought exactly the same. That's what he told me after 5 minutes when we spoke. The first day he came to the mixing, our studio, our album, sorry. And so the first time we met, we hated each other. And we, I don't know why. And then after 2 minutes, we en fait, t'es cool.
They just liked each other right after.
Thank you,
but
Thomas.
It was Thomas from Daft Punk who heard, he would come to the studio, he heard If I Ever Feel Better on Too Young. Mm-hmm. And we were mixing with someone that was, you know, that was, thought he was our producer. The record company sort of tricked us to get a better deal. So this guy who's a mixer producer. We didn't know he was a producer, so he was really getting involved. And we were not allowed to touch the mixing board. We were not, and finally we realized. We talked to one guy in the record company. We said we cannot do the record we want to do because this guy is not letting us do anything. Deck had to check the compressor's levels. He had to fake that he was tying his shoe. And so, well, I don't know how many times Deck tied his shoe during the. But at some point, like, it's not working. And finally, yeah, one guy of the record company came, saw what was happening, saw that this guy at some point almost smacked Deck's hand when he was at the... It was like, okay, that's it.
That's back to school again. That's yeah. like slapping you. Yeah.
And we were looking for a backup plan. And Thomas talked to Philippe Starr and said, I heard these two songs that are great and you should mix it. And he convinced us because he had a bad opinion about, thanks to Chris, because they hated each other from their first. And he came to the studio, and the first day of the studio, he was the most charismatic, the savior. He came, he mixed If I Ever Felt Better That Day, which was one of the... He was very proud that he started with the hardest song. He was like, I'm going to start with what I think is the most important song on the record and seduce them. And the next day, he brought us a pie that his wife had done for us. And then every day was like this. He would come with like a new something else. It's like, today we're going to... You know what? We're going to mix two songs today because I know it's going to be amazing. And then... he would be so involved, and he would stay till like 5 a.m. It was his record as well as our record, which was the opposite of the guy that was before him.
They say an end can be a start. Feels like a barber, it's still alive. It's like a bad day that never ends. I feel the chaos around me, a thing I don't try to deny. I better learn to accept that there are things in my life I can't control. They say love is nothing but a sore. I don't even know what love is. Too many tears I've had to fold. Don't you know I'm so tired of it all? I have no terror, these are spells. Finding out the secrets words won't tell. Whatever it is, it can be named. There's a part of my world that's fading away. You know I don't want to be clever, to be being a superior. True like ice, true like fire. Now I know that a breeze coming me away. Now I know there's much more dignity in defeat than a brother's victory. I'm losing my balance on the tightrope. Tell me please, tell me please, tell me please, tell me please. My place, I ain't even playing my own game. The rules have changed, well, I didn't know. There are things in my life I can't control. I feel the chaos around me, a thing I don't try to deny. I better learn to accept that there's a part of my life that would go away. Dark is the night, cold is the ground, and the sickle is solid to my heart. There's one that strives for hell to come. I am sure I come through, I don't know how. They say a man can be a star, feels like a barbarian still out. I'm losing my balance on the tightrope.
That was the brilliant If I Ever Feel Better from Phoenix's debut album. I will be finding out how they dealt with the success and a remarkably bad review that that record brought right after the Six Music News.
Six Music. B- BBC Radio 6 Music.
BBC News at 1:30. I'm Frances Reid. The authorities in Jersey say as many as 15 people may have been killed in an explosion which destroyed a block of flats in the early hours of yesterday. Emergency services are no longer looking for survivors after searching the area around the block in St Helier overnight. Jersey's Chief of Police, Robin Smith, told a news conference it looked likely that the explosion was caused by gas.
We have 3 confirmed fatalities. And I think it is fair to say that we expect to find more. Previously, we've said probably in the region of a dozen, but you will understand how difficult it is to make that assessment. But that's a number we hope we don't get to, but that's the number we are just sort of working to.
Scottish prosecutors say that a Libyan man accused of making the device used in the Lockerbie bombing is in American custody. A Pan Am plane exploded over the town in Dumfries and Galloway almost 34 years ago, killing 270 passengers, crew and residents of Lockerbie. US authorities announced charges against Abu Ajayla Massoud 2 years ago. A cabinet minister has signalled that an offer by nursing unions to press pause on strikes before Christmas and seek negotiations tomorrow with the health secretary will not be accepted by the government. The Royal College of Nursing has offered to suspend proposed action on the 15th and 20th of December if Steve Barclay agrees to negotiate properly on pay. But this morning, the Foreign Secretary, James Cleverly, appeared to rule out Mr. Barclay entering talks on nurses' salaries, saying it was up to their employer, the NHS. Our political editor, Helen Catt, explains what the union is asking for.
The RCN has said they've had many years of low inflation increases, and with the soaring cost of living, it's left a lot of their members in very difficult circumstances. And so they are calling for a much bigger rise of 5% over the RPI rate of inflation, which currently stands at about 14%. So currently, that would be a pay rise of 19%. So a big gap there.
Doctors at London's Great Ormond Street Hospital have used a revolutionary new type of cell therapy to successfully treat a teenage girl with leukemia. Genetically modified cells were able to target and kill cancer cells in their patient without damaging healthy ones. Alyssa, who's 13, had not previously responded to conventional treatments, but she's now free of cancer. She says she has a lot to look forward to.
Christmas, definitely. My auntie's wedding, I'm going to be her bridesmaid. To go back to school, to hang out with my friends. I want to start riding my bike again, things like that.
The England football team are on their way home from the World Cup in Qatar after their 2-1 defeat to the reigning champions France in the quarter-final last night. More than 21 million people watched the closing minutes on TV, which included a penalty miss by the captain, Harry Kane. That's 6 Music News. The next update's at 2:30.
BBC Radio 6 Music.
Out of it is all the same. I played all the games and lost almost everything. Now I talk to myself and it's quite surprising.
That was Tonight by my guests on the first time this week. Phoenix is taken from their latest record, Alpha Zulu, and we'll be hearing how medieval rooms in museums permeated the recording of that record. But let's dive back into my conversation with Tomas and Christian from the band, looking back at their first album, as I asked them what it was like dealing with the reaction to that record.
It was tricky because at that time the doors opened thanks to Air, mm-hmm. Daft Punk, Cassius. So we were not expecting, you know, we were not expecting to be a huge hit, but we were expecting some sort of, or at least the record company expected a good amount of success. And the first time we came to London, our record company here, Virgin Records at the time, were like, this is, the album you've made is so easy for radio. It's going to be played so much. And then we played this one show where everybody came, everybody hated the show, and we were never on the radio again.
Why? What? Can you remember the show?
Yeah.
It's a bigger...
There was a place called Tokyo Joe's. Do you remember this place?
Yeah.
Yes. So we played there.
It's our worst show ever.
It's the worst show you ever played.
Yeah.
And worst. That was it for 5 years.
Number one, yeah. But we learned a lot. We learned a lot with this show. Yeah.
The show that nearly killed the band.
Yeah, it killed us for 5 years, yeah. Yeah, or maybe 10.
Yeah, I was looking at, you spoke about this before.
Yeah.
You got 0 out of 10 in X-Mag.
Yeah.
I mean, that's almost brilliant. It's like, yeah,
that's my favorite review we ever had.
Yeah.
That's the best when people love your record. When you have a 10 and a 0, that's so much better than a 6.
Yeah.
You know, that's what you... As long as there's people that love the record, and then if you have a 0 out of 10, you know you did something good.
Yeah, I think it's kind of heroic about, like, because I'll if I read a review of something that's that bad, I'll want to go and listen to it because there's something there that's provoked somebody.
Yeah.
I quite like it. I mean, 10's good, but 0's pretty cool.
I think, 0's better than 10 because it worked.
And there was a big picture of us. It was a full page. The photographer came especially, and it was a stupid picture. We were in a jacuzzi with cigars. Like, it was one of our ideas, stupid idea, fun idea. And so we were, like, super cocky in bathtub, and there was a big 0. And all the reasons were, we were agreeing with the guy. We loved exactly what he was hating, you know, it was, perfect.
We're doing all these firsts. We have to talk about Lost in Translation. Was that the first film that any of your music was on?
Sort of. Virgin Suicide's Air was making the soundtrack, and I sang the Playground Love with them.
Right.
I think originally they wanted David Bowie to sing it. And I was the temp.
That's okay.
And I don't know if they never told me if they kept, because they had the first verse and I wrote the whole song. And then I don't know if they thought it would be problematic to rewrite everything or if they loved the temp or if David Bowie said no. I don't know the story. I should ask Nicola. But
they had the verse?
Had the first 4 lines.
Oh.
Yeah. So that was the first time, and I did Sundance Music Festival, movie festival, a few on the West Coast. Yeah, so that was the first time we were in Sophia's movie, and then Lost in Translation, she picked a song. We didn't really write anything. She picked the song, and we went to see, she came to Paris, she showed us the movie, And we loved the movie except for that scene, because every time I see, if you hear your own music, it takes you out of the... But Bill Murray dancing to our music was sort of the best music video. So yeah, that was the first time. And in every movie, there's a little, sometimes it's just, either we did the score or she picked a song.
When it comes to alphabetical, D'Angelo is someone that you talked about being kind of like, it wasn't happening. You were going to make the same record again. What's the point? And then he was the artist that kind of unlocked.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. You know what?
He created a lot of problems because he... Yeah.
Because when, yeah, we still remember in Paris in the shop where I put the headphones to listen, you know, at that time you would listen to CDs. I thought the groove, I thought there was a problem. You know, the first 20 seconds, I was like, I couldn't believe it, you know, the groove. It was a new way of playing with sounds. And we were traumatized, really traumatized by this album. So for 6 months, we couldn't write a...
Six months?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, maybe 1 year, we wrote zero songs, and going every day in the studio, you know, every day. We are living together in Paris, going through Versailles, like at 2 p.m., staying there until 4 a.m. for 6 months, zero. The result, zero, you know. But in a way, it helped us. Because
it's someone that changed the whole DNA of... And also, the first time we heard his music, we didn't know where it was coming from. We didn't hear... all his influences. We didn't hear the progression of, you know, Jay Dilla making the, or every, so we didn't understand it, but it was so good and different that we thought we were not making it a regular drum beat ever again. We have to, so we spent more time building our studio. We created these rooms that were really dry. We spent a year just recording things with knowing that we were not going to use them.
Let me tell you about this girl, baby, I should. I met her in Philly and her name was Brown. See, we be making love constantly. That's why my eyes are a shade blood burgundy. The way that we kiss is unlike any other way that I be kissing. When I'm kissing, what I'm missing, won't you listen? Brown sugar, babe, I guess high up your love, I don't know how to be.
Imagine, like, every day, working, end of the day, no.
Yeah.
Nothing. Following day, work, no. That's quite heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Especially on your second album.
Yeah.
Because the second album is, the clock's running. It's the most amount of stress we've had, I think, on the second album. And it's the hardest time in the studio. There were days where we really... were questioning how we were making music and how, and we wrote this song where we thought, well, let's have something ambitious and have this orchestra piece play it, and it cost us a lot of money, and we made this song, and after that one session we thought, we cannot use this, we're starting from scratch, we don't have any more money, but we felt good about it. That was the beginning of, like, finally we're free of all the weight we had for this 1 year, that we thought we found a way to make it different.
Things are gonna change, and not for better. Don't know what it means to me, but it's hopeless, hopeless. Gotta get you home, could be with anyone. I think of what I've done, you know it all.
Because you've known each other for so long, you've been going together as musicians for so long, how you operate, like, as a democracy? Because every band operates differently. There's a lovely Radiohead quote where someone asks Tom York about, oh, is Radiohead democratic? He says, Radiohead, it's like the United Nations, but I'm America. And you're like, okay, then you can see how it works. I just kind of wondered how you, because you seem to be, however you've worked out a way of making it work, it clearly works.
Let's say we're all Scandinavian. No, because even in Scandinavia, there's like the Swedish are, and the Norwegian have the money. No, we are, for us, it's ridiculously democratic. Yeah. The veto rule exists for certain things, but it's really, it's when we know that something is will be on the record when the four of us will agree on something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It can happen after spending so much time on something, you're exhausted and you know, the one person that's resisting will give up because the other ones are so into it. And so it's also why we enjoy being together and making albums together. It's because it's democratic. Otherwise, you know, even the pressure, I wouldn't be able to deal with the pressure if you're the only one thinking. Once, if one person thinks it's good, the other ones are not convinced. As soon as the thing is a success or a failure, it creates already, I told you so, or I knew it. And it's the beginning of, there's no, if we scratch something together or with veto rule, you know, if one thing never shows, you'll never know. And that's way better.
Wolfgang Amadeus Phoenix, it's one of those records, isn't it? It's the record that changes everything. I don't think it would have bothered you had it not gone massive. But then people just, especially in America, people just love that record. I just wondered how that felt when you first realised, okay, this has got really, really big. Do we want it to be big? Are we going to enjoy this? Because there's no roadmap for that.
Yeah, but you know, our first gig, we were the worst gig of our life. We were not ready at all. But when we for Wolfgang, we played like all across America. We played, I don't know how many shows, maybe more than 100 shows. Mm-hmm. So we were ready.
Yeah. You know?
And so it was very, just to be between friends and to see a success. But we are still controlling what we wanted to do.
Were you still able to do that though?
You know what? Yes.
It's hard.
Yeah, it's very hard. But we were, you know, for after three albums, we knew the tools to protect ourselves. So yeah, it was very enjoyable moments. Yeah, with lots of pressure, but fun pressure. Yeah, it was very even in the failures. It was even the best moments, the moments we remember the most. You know, so
yeah. Yeah, but 1901 is played at on a Super Bowl advert. You're like, that's different.
We did have a lot of frat boys coming to towards the end of the tour.
Phoenix!
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
There were a lot of frat boys that we were.
Yeah, you're doing. Yeah. Yeah. We heard exactly this. Yeah, Phoenix.
What's the Nirvana song that he's the one who. He sings all the pretty. He doesn't know what it means.
He's the one, yeah. Sings all your pretty songs.
That felt the same. We were looking at these frat boys everywhere in the U.S. and we were happy to, you know, because you can't, if you play an arena, there will be, you know, that there's maybe, I don't know, best case scenario, 80% of music lovers and 20% of people of yeah, frat boys.
And
Alpha Zulu, this was done pretty quick, wasn't it, for you?
Yes, yes, yeah.
It's only 5 years.
I mean, yeah, but like, not, you know, like, actually, the kind of initial recording.
The initial, session. Yeah, it was done in 3 minutes. And then it's 2 years of, for small details, but details are important. But yeah, we, actually, the whole album was done in a very subconscious way, very fast. Because Thomas was stuck in America with the COVID thing. And when he came after 9 months, we were like, wow, we were like kids, ecstatic. And so we recorded nonstop for 10 days. We didn't know when we'd come back. So yeah, this one, this song and many other songs, they're very, very fast. And all the lyrics, they came to Thomas.
Quick.
Yeah.
In terms of where you recorded it, which is obviously something that everyone's asking you about. There's a quote where you said, when you grew up, you lived in a museum, and now actually you've gone to record a record in a museum.
Yeah.
So there's that.
Yeah,
everything comes full circle.
Yeah.
Yeah. The first month we were in the Louvre, we thought, why did we do that to ourselves? Because it's the same pressure of the establishment and
exactly, this is what I mean.
Yeah, being worried that you're too loud for, you know, that you're going to disturb that you're going to get kicked out any second. And
did you still think that, even though all you've done?
Yeah.
All the work you've done, how you have absorbed Versailles into your character, and more people probably globally know about that as a musical place, younger kids do, even though you're still thinking, oh, there's going to be someone that's going to tell us to turn that down.
No, this is all the years that we talked about in school, and I think it took us it took me a month maybe, but then we were invited there, and the pandemic happened. So we were on our own in the museum, which was the most surreal.
Just the guards and us.
Surreal experience, because it's great to be, we're so happy to have the studio there. But to be on your own at night
was incredible. We had the keys, you know, of all the doors.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that was impossible to forget.
And you wandered around, obviously, late at night.
Yeah, yeah. It's a big, it's very big. So.
Yeah. What was your favorite piece to look at when there was no one else around?
My favorite place was a medieval room.
Yeah.
Because at night, one guard told me there was a ghost there, super seriously. And they are all crazy there because, yeah, it's a crazy job. And the smell of the wood at night, it was not like a museum, you know. I could really feel.
You have to enjoy that room. You cannot enjoy that room as a visitor because you have, it's almost like the sky. If you, there's so much light pollution that you don't see the stars, you know. The medieval room is the same. The light pollution from the museum is so strong that when you enter the room, you have to stay 15 minutes and then you realize what it's like to live 600 years ago with those candles, and you're starting to see all the details and everything. So it's not something you can do when there's a line of people and then they're kicking you out, and you realize that they've done the lighting thinking to do it justice, to do it this way, but no one's actually seeing those rooms the right way.
I would have been so tempted to push like an amplifier out in front of like some amazing like Van Gogh or Gauguin or something,
yeah,
Kandinsky, and just play while looking at it.
There's Napoleon's throne. I was really tempted to sit on. I didn't do it because I thought that would be like they'd kick us out instantly.
But it would have been a good vocal take.
It would have been a great vocal take.
obviously Philippe Zadar's memory would have been with you for the whole of this.
Yeah, for sure, yeah.
Yeah.
We started the record after his funeral, 3 days after. So he was with us all the first song we recorded was right after. And the lyrics are full on about him. There's nothing cryptic. And then the rest, we thought of him all the time, yeah.
What was he saying to you?
Well, he always had, there are certain things for him that are very important that was not important for us. You should have the album title in the beginning before you even start something.
Right.
Track listing was huge. How to highlight a chorus. Yeah, all these little points of references.
I wrote them because he had so many concepts. A few days after he passed away, I have a notebook with all the... So I didn't want to forget, you know, all of his crazy rules he had.
Final question, what's the last song that we should play? I know you've got some songs that are kind of linked to this new record.
Well, Very Disco by Daft Punk is one of my favorites, but it's also the reason why Thomas from Daft Punk came to help us in the studio a little bit. He came only two, three times, and it's because Philippe wasn't there. So
he introduced us to Philippe.
Yeah.
So we thought it was he had to do it to help us, because we always need at one moment a guy, a friend, and he did a fantastic job.
That's the last song we shall play. Thank you very much, guys. It's been lovely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Same.
Quo by Daft Punk, the final choice of my guests on the first time this week, Thomas and Christian from Phoenix. We'll be back next Sunday with jazz musician, saxophonist, bandleader and all-round hero Shebeka Hutchins. So prepare yourself for some live in-studio Japanese flute. Until then, I'm Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.